50 years ago, Mary Beth Tinker of Des Moines walked into a school with a black armband to mourn the lives lost in the Vietnam War. The result was a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll talk with Tinker about this case, its legacy, and how it applies to free speech for students today. Also on the program, the feds delay the governor's plans for Medicaid, sleuthing a mysterious pig virus, a low-tech solution for developing world cook stoves that's made in Iowa, celebrities bring joy to vocabulary tests at a West Branch school, and how the Rose Bowl on January 1st will be filled with black and gold. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about the news this week. We've got about a half dozen conversations for you this hour. Let's start off with this. Governor Terry Branstad, he's been pushing to transfer Medicaid management to national for-profit companies. That, as of January 1st, that was his plan. However, this week we heard that federal administrators have ordered Iowa to wait at least 60 days before shifting its Medicaid program to private management. And that delay, announced yesterday, will affect over 500,000 poor or disabled Iowans who receive health care under the $4 billion Medicaid program. Brian Caskey joins us once again, Associate Professor of Health Management and Policy at the University of Iowa, to explain a little bit about this delay. Hello, Brian.
Hi there.
How expected was this order from the federal government to delay at least 60 days?
I actually think this was to be expected. First, despite the suggestion that our state is simply following on what has happened in other states, what has been proposed here is actually quite comprehensive and complex. The Iowa Medicaid modernization involves a combination of several existing programs and services and the turnover of key personnel and management. And the actual application itself amounted to more than hundreds and hundreds of pages, each of which had to be reviewed by federal officials. So given the scope and complexity of it all, the federal reviewers certainly were likely to identify points that required some corrective course of action. In fact, it probably would have been unprecedented if such a comprehensive and complex proposal was reviewed and approved without a delay.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, as you know, there's been a considerable amount of concern expressed about this proposed change to the Medicaid program, voiced by both the people who are enrolled in Medicaid and from the providers themselves, including hospital administrators, physicians, and care managers. So with such a strong and diverse number of people who were concerned about moving this forward, it certainly would have been conspicuous if CMS reviewed and approved the proposal without delay as well.
Brian, for you as a public health policy expert, does the delay make sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this, like I said, it's what we're doing here is really pushing our Medicaid system into a whole new area, and we're also pushing it in a way that is not in line necessarily with what has happened in other states. What the governor is proposing is very, like I said, comprehensive and complex.
Mm-hmm. I guess this begs the question, probably goes into politics, but one would wonder, why didn't the governor delay it himself if it was likely to be judged as rushed and go badly?
Well, I don't think anybody wants to elect a governor who's not willing to take on such a leadership role and state something like, well, you know, we'll get this implemented when we get all the I's dotted and T's crossed. I think people look to governors to stake out leadership positions like this and say, hey, this is my vision, and this is where I think we should go with this program, and I'm putting all my efforts to get us there. So, you know, whether it be our current governor or one of our previous governors, I would expect from a leader to kind of take that front end of the boat, if you will, and push us forward.
How does this affect the Medicaid privatization process going forward, especially for those over 500,000 who are enrolled in it?
Well, let's remind ourselves that the state has effectively been moving towards this goal to modernize Medicaid for a few years now. So a two-month delay certainly is not going to derail the effort. Still, since the state has maintained the position that the waiver would be approved and operations would begin in a few weeks on January 1st, we are left to wonder what will happen in the next few months. So some of the pragmatic concerns, for example, is that many of the on-the-ground providers who previously worked for companies that were offering Medicaid services have left those groups and signed contracts with managed care companies under the assumption that operations would begin January 1. Well, now that those companies can't begin operations until March 1, there's a window there that needs to be closed somehow. Will our Medicaid beneficiaries still receive services from the existing program providers, some of which have lost their staff to the MCOs or have shut down altogether? I don't know at this time, but I do assume we'll be hearing something pretty soon from Iowa Medicaid Enterprise.
Okay, thank you very much. Brian Caskey, Associate Professor of Health Management and Policy at the University of Iowa, talking with us about this week's decision from federal administrators ordering Iowa to wait at least 60 days before shifting its Medicaid program to private management. Thanks for joining us again, Brian Caskey.
Thank you for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you may not know much about it, but it's likely you've paid the price for it. If you and your family consume bacon, ribs, and chops, that is, porcine epidemic diarrhea, PED. It's a virus that has killed millions of pigs over the past 2.5 years, as much as 1/10 of the total U.S. swine herd. Amy Mayer joins us, Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media reporter. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
You have been talking to the sleuths who have been unraveling the mystery of this virus, haven't you?
That's right. Yes, it's been a while.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that made this virus so mysterious?
It's a virus that veterinarians and producers here in the United States knew existed. It was found in Europe and Asia. But when it first came here, it looked like other diarrhea-causing diseases that swine can get. So it took a little while to realize that it was not a familiar virus. And then once they were able to identify it as PED, a lot of questions came up about where it came from, how it got to this country, and then why it spread so quickly and so unpredictably through the swine herd.
Mm-hmm. What makes it an unfamiliar virus?
Sometimes diseases that don't exist in one country but exist elsewhere are called foreign animal diseases. Sometimes they use the term transboundary. And as far as I understand it, kind of the distinction is that foreign animal disease is this very specific category of things that producers and veterinarians and federal officials are monitoring abroad because they know that if they came to this country, they could be devastating, they could be potentially harmful to the food supply or to human health. PED wasn't one of those. PED was just a swine disease that existed, and there wasn't a whole lot of fear or anticipation that it would come here. And so then when it did, people were, even though they knew it was out there, were kind of caught unawares.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the answers to the questions that you posed a moment ago, the mystery here about where it came from and when.
What they've been able to piece together is that genetically, the virus that was first found here looks a lot like the virus in China. And we know that there's a lot of movement of goods and feed and animals and people between China and the United States. So there's a pretty solid consensus that USPED came here from China. And then things still remain rather murky. There's been some research that suggests this virus is able to survive in feed or in feed ingredients. So if something was brought here and then made into swine feed, maybe that's a way that the virus got onto a hog farm. The USDA did some modeling studies to see what could be feasible, and they tested a lot of different hypotheses and were able to rule out some of them. So, for example, it's not feral pigs in China who sent this disease here.
Mm-hmm.
But they looked at shipping containers, specifically these woven fabric bulk totes that are used for all sorts of things. And they were able to show that the virus can survive in that material. But this was all just done in a lab. So they aren't able to say definitively, here's how it got here.
I understand that last winter there were
fewer infections, many fewer in deaths than there were the previous winter, 2013-2014. Is the industry still on edge this year?
People are very much on edge this year, and the reason is nobody can say conclusively why last year was such an improvement over the year before. And so the two hypotheses are either people got a lot more rigid in their biosecurity. They started complying with those regulations about showering in or changing boots and limiting visitors and so forth. They became much more rigid about adhering to those rules. And so they successfully rid themselves of the risk. Or the herd had some immunity built up from exposure during that first terrible winter. Mm. So if the reason last year was better was herd immunity, the herd is vulnerable this year because many fewer animals have experienced the virus.
When you use a term like biosecurity on our farms, it makes me also think, of course, of the avian flu.
Right.
Now, is there any sort of connection?
I posed that question to a couple of people. And first of all, the two viruses are completely different and unrelated. So that's relevant. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the virologist at Iowa State, KJ Yoon, told me that precisely because of the work that's been done with PED in relation to feed, they are now looking into whether feed could have been a factor in the spread of bird flu this summer. To my knowledge, no one's published anything on that yet. It's just an additional hypothesis that they likely wouldn't have considered had they not seen what happened with PED.
If, as is thought by many, that the virus is got into the system and in the feed, what can the makers or mills or producers of the food feed do to reduce the risk of pigs getting sick from their food?
Some researchers at Kansas State University have really been exploring this question, as has the detective veterinarian who I wrote about in my piece. A couple of possibilities. Treating the feed. So there are some different liquid antimicrobials, you know, a protective substance that you could apply to the feed could protect it. There are also some things that are not antimicrobial that might be a little more favorable because they wouldn't have that contribution to antibiotic resistance potential. So there's some other things made to kill the virus but not using the same antimicrobial compounds. And then also some concerns about how to monitor what comes in. Another thing that can protect the piglets who are most vulnerable is that if there's a threat of contamination in a batch of feed, make sure that that feed is formulated for older pigs who, if they were to get infected, would survive the infection. Whereas if it's made into nursery feed, then you have the situation of potentially piglets getting infected and they may not survive.
Mm-hmm. What has this done to demand for pork, or the consumption of pork dropped off?
It doesn't seem to have. I mean, in the summer of 2014, when prices had gone up about 11% over the year before, people were still eating pork. They were still buying it. And the prices have regulated to some degree since then, so we're not seeing those inflated prices. And I have not seen any numbers to suggest people are slowing down their bacon habits.
Mm-hmm. And this does not pose any risk to consumers. People can go along as they were before, eating their bacon and ribs and so forth.
That's right. I mean, sick animals wouldn't be sent to slaughter. But for the most part, like I said, the older animals recover, and so they're healthy and they can be sent to slaughter. And even if somehow the PED virus got to into a slaughterhouse or something, it doesn't cause any damage to the meat and it doesn't affect humans. So no people are going to get sick from this virus.
Mm-hmm. Some may wonder why, because we are such a grain basket here, that we import perhaps feed from China that may have been infected.
This surprised me. And when I asked the researcher who I was interviewing about this, he said he too, I mean, the swine veterinarian who's worked in the Midwest for years, was also surprised to see just the quantity of soybeans and soybean meal that we import from China. And we do export a lot of soy to China. So it's definitely surprising. And I think it just is indicative of the global marketplace and how everyone is looking to get the best price on whatever it is they need. And, you know, feeding animals is a year-round prospect. Grain is harvested and marketed according to certain schedules. So it just,
it does. Maybe some more sleuthing is needed there, Amy Mayer, to find out why we are shipping grain to them and they're shipping grain back
to us.
To us.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and plenty of other ingredients also coming from China.
Okay. Thank you very much for explaining this story, this mystery of the porcine epidemic diarrhea, PED virus, that has killed millions of pigs over the past 2.5 years. Amy Mayer, we appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben.
Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media reporter Amy Mayer. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Let's go to this. 50 years ago, some history. to look back on. A 13-year-old named Mary Beth Tinker of Des Moines, along with siblings and a friend, walked into school with black armbands. They were doing that to mourn and to protest the lives lost in the Vietnam War. The resulting controversy ended in a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision we know as Tinker versus Des Moines Independent Community School District. It defined the constitutional rights of students in U.S. public schools. The Tinker test is still used by courts today to determine whether a school's disciplinary actions violate students' First Amendment rights. We are now joined and very pleased to have with us, 50 years after she entered school in Des Moines with that black armband, Mary Beth Tinker, now a student rights activist. Mary Beth Tinker, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. Thanks for having me here today. It's been such a great week in Des Moines, talking with students all over Des Moines in the schools, and we're just having a wonderful week celebrating 50 years.
Mm-hmm. In a nutshell, what did the High Court say when it was decided in 1969, 4 years after your action?
The Supreme Court ruled by 7-2 that neither students or teachers leave their constitutional rights to expression when they enter the schoolhouse gate. And they said that students are persons under our Constitution and that schools should not be enclaves of totalitarianism. And it was a wonderful ruling about what education should be in a democracy, that there should be an interchange of ideas, and that youth need to be able to express themselves in order to model the ideals of democracy, and that if there was ever a place where young people can learn those principles, it should be school.
Mm-hmm. You have advocated for the rights of teenagers and free expression in the meantime for the decades between your action then and now. What are the issues, the examples of freedom of speech and students that you can point to from recent years?
Oh, there are so many examples that I could give you just from Des Moines, but just traveling around the country, students are speaking up about they want to have a say in their schools. At Tacoma Park, Maryland, students joined with adults to lower the voting age in Tacoma Park to 16, so now students can vote for school board. And there's an effort to do that in other places as well. In North Dakota, I was there this year, where students have succeeded, actually, in passing legislation that's modeled on Iowa's legislation that gives students more rights in their student journalism. There are 8 states around the country where students do have more rights in as student journalists, and Iowa is one of them. And so students around the country are pushing to have that. Students want to speak up about the environment. Girl Scouts have campaigns to get palm oil out of their Girl Scout cookies. Of course, there are the Black Lives Matter campaign. A girl in Birmingham, Alabama, just wrote to me about how she wants to put up some artwork in her school about Black Lives Matter. And there are just so many issues going on around the country where students are speaking up. And I feel like there's really something afoot. It's as a student told me recently, we're in mighty times now, and it certainly feels like it's mighty times when it comes to youth wanting to have a voice.
Yeah, you say something afoot, something momentous, something big and different?
It feels like it. And as I ask the students around the country, I've been traveling. I traveled 25,000 miles in the last couple of years and went to over 100 schools all over. And students say that they feel that way also, that they are speaking up and they're more tuned in to what's going on, and they realize how much these issues affect their lives, and they want to be a part of it. And when students are part of the decisions and policies that affect their lives and their schools, it's better for everyone. It works better. School seems to go better. They have a higher success, which is really important to me, student success in school, because I'm a pediatric nurse. And so I learned that the most important thing for students' health is if they graduate high school. So I want school to be a place where kids want to be, and it seems that they want to be in school when they have a say about their schools and when they like being there and they really, have a part to play in it. And that is what's going on in the Des Moines schools. It's so strong. We felt it so much this week as we were in Roosevelt North. We just came from Lincoln. We were in Harding. We were in 5 elementary schools. And the climate in the schools is really great because the students do feel like they have a part. And there is a huge emphasis on arts and music and expression, like the Movement 515 program, the Bridges to Harmony group at Roosevelt with their beautiful, beautiful singing and how they're expressing, you know, issues of the day through music and art.
And yes, we have to admit that expressions, freedom of speech expressions in school can be disruptive. Where do we know the line is? Where is the line?
Yes, when the Supreme Court ruled in Tinker in 1969, they said that there are rights for students in the public schools, except for two things, that students cannot substantially disrupt school, and students cannot impinge on the rights of others. Now, there were three cases, and also it was an ACLU case. The American Civil Liberties Union goes to the Supreme Court more than any organization in the United States. So the ACLU had our case. A wonderful lawyer named Dan Johnston, he had just graduated from law school, and he took our case. But that was the two exceptions to student speech rights. Now, there were several cases since then at the Supreme Court that cut back on the rights of students a little bit and said that, also, students cannot have lewd and obscene speech in school, and students also cannot promote drug use. And those cases were also ACLU cases. Mm-hmm. But where the lines are, but the basic precedent of the Tinker case remains, that students have rights to express themselves in school unless it's substantially disruptive or impinges on the rights of others. Now, where that line is it's a very gray area. And so, you know, there are different interpretations of it. The Ninth Circuit in California recently ruled that that means that students couldn't wear American flag shirts to their school because they said they felt it was going to be disruptive because the kids were wearing those shirts to.
Mary Beth, are you still there? Mary Beth, I'm afraid we've lost the live telephone link to Mary Beth Tinker, who is telling us, that's a shame, 50 years ago, she, as a 13-year-old, went into a Des Moines school along with her siblings and a friend. They walked into the school with black armbands to mourn the lives lost in the Vietnam War. It resulted. She was suspended along with her older brother, I believe, John, and also a friend, Christopher Eckhart. And years later, it ended in a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision we know as Tinker versus Des Moines Independent School District. Again, sorry that we lost that connection, but we got the bulk of it in there. We're coming up on a break here. Coming up in just a few minutes after we take a short break, we'll talk about a low-tech solution for developing developing world cook stoves. It's a solution made in Iowa. We'll talk with the creator of that special grate for cooking. Also, celebrities bringing joy to vocabulary tests at a West Branch school, and how the Rose Bowl on January 1st will be filled with black and gold. Coming up on Monday on this program, after we get through the weekend, I will dive into political analyst Chris Larimer's latest book, Gubernatorial Stability in Iowa. That's a book that takes a look at the longevity of Iowa's governors, their popularity in the state, and why Iowans expect a politician to be familiar, friendly, and loyal. Also, Joyce Russell will join us on Monday. The 2016 legislative session is only weeks away. That starts on the 11th of January. Chris Larimer and Joyce Russell will give us a preview of what the session will hold: education funding, income tax reform, economic growth, job skill gaps, environmental concerns. That's on Monday's program. Just a moment, and we'll be back with more of this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations on our NewsBuzz editions on Fridays. And still to come this hour, a West Branch teacher with a brilliant, brilliant idea for sprucing up those old spelling lessons. And we'll find out how crazy the Hawks are about the upcoming Rose Bowl on January 1st. How many Hawks are going to Pasadena? But first, a lot of high tech under Christmas trees this year, no doubt. We know high tech offers us many wonderful solutions to problems, but sometimes the best solution is decidedly low-tech. Case in point, let's talk to H.S. Udaykumar. He's a professor of mechanical and industrial engineering at the University of Iowa, and he's created an inexpensive metal insert for primitive cook stoves, and it may decrease global warming and potentially save the lives of thousands of women and children. His study was published in the November issue of Solutions. Udaykumar, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Uday, tell us, you traveled to India to solve a problem. First, describe the problem, the magnitude of what was going on there, or what is going on there.
Well, it's actually not just an India problem. It's a problem in developing countries in general, because people there cannot afford to have fossil fuels to cook and do other things. Their main energy source is wood. For example, in some countries in Africa, 95% of their energy is supplied by wood. In India, it's very different because while the cities have electricity and so on, remote villages are still not connected. And so the place where we go, it's a very remote tribal area in India, and there people cook with firewood. So they live on the edge of a forest, and they keep extracting firewood every single day. And so what happens is that there's a huge pressure on the forest. And so the forest loses trees. And this eventually leads to desertification.
And loss of species as well.
Oh, yeah. Loss of species. Intense ecological damage of all kinds. This particular place happens to be on the edge of a desert. And so if they lose trees, the desert moves over. And, it can be very dire consequences.
Mm-hmm. So you set out to solve this problem, and I understand it had been people have been trying to solve this through some sort of high efficiency stoves, maybe solar stoves. They did not catch on. Why not?
Well, solar stoves would be a great solution because you could just use the sun, and so you would not need much wood to cook with. But they are very expensive. At least the ones that we wanted to create were in the $200 range. These are people who live at, $1 a day, so that would be totally unaffordable to them.
Mm-hmm.
The high-efficiency cook stoves, actually, the government of India is pushing those. Those cost about $30 on the average, which also actually is not affordable to these villagers. And additionally, those $30 high-efficiency cook stoves are not terribly robust. They break down in 6 months to a year.
So you came up with a metal insert. This is sort of a grate that fits in a traditional type of stove or a cooking thing?
Oh, yeah. The nice thing is they don't have to change anything, One of the impediments to inserting new technologies in these places is that there are lots of cultural and other, social issues that kind of impede the progress of these technologies. To be sure, some technologies, fly through easily. For example, cell phones. Cell phone coverage in rural India is amazing, even in the most remote places. And these people have cell phones.
Hmm.
But if you're trying to give them a high-efficiency cook stove, they don't use it.
Wow.
It's
strange.
Really strange. They have motorcycles. They have cell phones. We tried intervening with solar lights, and that took off like crazy. That was, immediately adopted. But for some reason, cooking is so, I don't know what it is, my colleagues in women's studies call it the heart of the home,
So
kind of trying to intervene in there and change that practice has a lot of resistance.
So this little metal grate is more efficient and it retains whatever we can't sort of put our finger on about the heart of the home there. It is inserted in what they already have. They can burn their wood, and it helps it burn more efficiently and with less of these carbons?
That's all it is. That's all it is. It's just encouraging airflow in their heart. It's basically what happens is when they load wood in, typically they cook at very high temperatures because they're cooking flatbreads. It's like pizza ovens, right? It takes very high temperatures to make it right. And these thick flatbreads need high temperature. So they pile on a lot of wood. But as they keep piling on wood, the ash and embers accumulate around it, and it chokes off airflow. And so the wood burns less and less efficiently. And when wood burns less efficiently, it produces a lot of soot. And the soot goes up in the air into the atmosphere. It goes into their lungs. And about 4 million people in the world actually suffer every year and consequences of smoke inhalation around the world, primarily in developing countries, and primarily women and children. So the soot that comes out of inefficient burning is bad for them. It's bad for in terms of climate change because it goes up into the atmosphere and then it lands on ice and it darkens ice. And when that happens, more radiation is absorbed.
You're right.
So it's a global thing. We think of these as local problems that apply to women and children in these really remote areas. But actually, it's a global problem because it connects to all of us, not only in terms of climate change, but also in terms of deforestation. Because as forests disappear, not just in India, but let's say in Brazil, in the Amazon, or in Indonesia, due to forest burning, all that soot goes up in the air, and the forests disappear. And when the forests disappear, our ability to sequester carbon dioxide goes away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a double whammy in that sense.
Right. In the few seconds we have remaining, Uday, tell us, how will these grates find their way to the developing world to be used, or are they being there used already?
So we have started supplying these in villages in Rajasthan, so we have 2,000 pieces there. We are doing more tests, actually, on those 2,000 pieces and seeing how that affects their cooking styles and what the women think about them and whether they like them or not. And then based on that feedback, we plan to disseminate the technology. And we're talking to several people, the government of India and institutions in India, and trying to promote, first looking at this as an initial starting part, rather than going for a high-efficiency cook stove, which is $30.
Right.
The government of India actually offered a subsidy on those $30 cook stoves to the tune of $7. What we're saying is this is way below even the subsidy you're offering. And it's a simple thing. Just there should be no real resistance to just sticking this in their traditional hearts.
Okay. We'll check back with you. Thank you very much, H.S. Uday Kumar. He's a University of Iowa researcher who has created an inexpensive metal insert for primitive cook stoves that may decrease global warming and potentially save lives of thousands of women and children. The study published in the November issue of Solutions. Uday, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Remember the spelling tests from elementary and middle school? You'd get that list of new words from your teacher, probably on Monday, the start of the week. That was the pretest. You get a few wrong. That was okay, though, because a few days later, at the end of the week, there was that post-test. There, that same list of words, you had no excuse at that time to get any of them wrong. Well, that's how I remember it. Joining me now, a man who came up with a way to make a traditional spelling, or rather a vocabulary test, much more exciting. Jim Calkins is with me, a language arts teacher for 6th and 7th grade at West Branch Middle School. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
So is it the same way as I remember it? Beginning of the week, you get a list. The end of the week, you better know that list.
A lot of it's very similar, except we emphasize the vocabulary. The spelling counts, but we really want the students to be able to use the words in the classes that we get the words from.
Okay. You have an innovation here. Tell us what your innovation is.
Well, at the start of the year, we really approached vocabulary differently this year. Carrie Arlen, my incredible teaching partner at school, said we should work to get words from all over the school and every curriculum area. But then 1 month ago today, our principal, Sarah Oswald, showed us a TEDx video from Dean Cheresky. And as part of that, a Canadian teacher got ordinary folks or very special folks to do video presentation words. One of his presenters was from a pro hockey player, but that was Canada after all. So right away I went home and sent a message to a lot of my Facebook friends. And the next morning I got replies from people everywhere from Brazil to Australia to Thailand. And next thing you know, Dan Coffey from his home in Thailand put on his Scrooge best voice and did words from Dickens' Christmas Carol. We have taken off from there.
Right, right. We have a little bit of that audio from Dan Coffey. Public radio listeners will know him as Dr. Science. Dan Coffey, an Iowa native, also of Duck's Breath Mystery Theater. Let's listen to a little excerpt, Jim, of what he did for your class to start off the vocabulary list. Here's Dan Coffey.
As for me, I'm Dan Coffey, and I fled the United States and moved to lush Thailand as an economic migrant. And glad of it. Listen to these words now. I'm going to say them only once. Homage. The English say homage because they're stupid. But we Americans say homage, like we're French or something.
That had to delight the class.
It did. And our original, the guy that showed us the idea, Dean Shoresky, said you've got to bring joy into the classroom because a strong positive emotion really reinforces all the learning. And so I think this has really done that for the kids.
Mm-hmm. So do you think it improves test scores? It motivates them?
I think it does, because every once in a while when they're using their words and vocabulary sentences, it will echo the way that the presenter on Monday gave us the words. And so that's just, it's a tremendous, I won't even say a bonus. It really locks in a lot of the learning for the students.
Let's play a little more audio. This is, tell us, we're going to hear a clip from the CBS late night band, these members. How did you get in touch with them?
Well, first, when a couple of years ago, right before John Batiste and his Stay Human band really took off, they played at the Englert, and a few of us got a chance after their sound check to play on stage with them in a little jam session, and it was an overwhelmingly wonderful experience. I don't know if that helped or not, but I emailed Eddie Borbash, the sax player for the group, and said, hey, would you do this? And sure enough, less than a day later, I got him backstage with some of the other band members reciting the words for us.
Okay, with a little music. Let's listen to a little snippet of it.
Hello, West Branch Middle School. My name is Eddie Barbash, and I play in the Late Show Band, and I'm going to read you your vocabulary words for this week with the other members of our band. Your first word is lyrics.
Second word, verse.
Third word, chorus.
All right. Wow, I would have loved to have been in your class to do this. I have to imagine, do you have a lot of applicants now, people getting in touch with you via Facebook to please, may I do your word list?
We haven't had that happen yet, but it's been fun. Everyone suggests people, and the hard thing is if it's a real celeb, it's hard to get a hold of those people. But Carrie Arlen is just, she's a total fan. So she's lined up and got a video from a star of a major Broadway show. She's got the voice of a cartoon character's voice that all the kids recognized. One student, when she heard it, melted into a little puddle on the floor that she still can't get over that. And we've got a list of other people from a couple of major motion pictures that said that they would contribute. And it's kind of getting a little bit scary. A lot of those name people we have to keep in house, so I kind of can't tell you who they are.
Okay.
But the kids will recognize them and be amazed. And then we're going to do some mythology. And so I got a archaeologist in Greece, and he asked me if he would rather have us do standing in front of the Acropolis or the Agora as he recites the words.
Amazing. Well, we wish you well in this. This is a very young venture. I'm sure it will turn out well. Jim Calkins, language arts teacher for the 6th and 7th grade at West Branch Middle School, has come up with a very joyful way to take a vocabulary test. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks for having me over.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Iowa Hawkeyes will face the Stanford Cardinals in the January 1st Rose Bowl. And with Iowa returning to play in the granddaddy of them all, after a 25-year absence, you can expect plenty of black and gold in those stands. Joining me now to talk about fan enthusiasm and how many Hawkeyes will be making that 1,800-mile trip to Pasadena, California, Jeff Keeter, President and Chief Executive Officer of the University of Iowa Alumni Association. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on.
So give us an idea of the response this game has gotten.
Overwhelming. You can tell that the Iowa fan base has been waiting 25 years to go back to the Rose Bowl, and they're turning out in full force to paint Los Angeles black and gold come next week.
Now, through the Alumni Association, you have offered packages. I don't imagine any of those are long gone.
Yes, it took about 6 hours for us to sell out.
6 hours. How many packages?
We are traveling just over 2,000 people to the Rose Bowl from Iowa here. From Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, and the Quad Cities, and then we have hundreds more that are descending on Los Angeles from around the country, people who bought land-only packages. We have a national alumni base at Iowa, and we wanted to make sure that we were able to open up that tour to anyone from around the country who wanted to make the trek.
Okay. What was the initial cost? Because I know it's quite different now. The initial cost of a ticket to the game?
Face value cost for the game is $150 or $185, as I recall.
Okay,
depending where you want to sit.
Do you have an idea of what you would have to spend if you really wanted a ticket right now?
Right. Well, the secondary market's come down quite a bit. In the immediate aftermath of the game, of the announcement, the secondary market was red hot. Tickets were $1,000 or more for even bad seats in the stadium.
Wow.
Since the allocations have been made by both schools earlier this week, and the Stanford fans have, I think, begun to dump some of their tickets, prices have come down quite a bit. Yesterday, when I was looking at one secondary site, you could get a ticket in the higher up in the grandstand for $250, which is $100 over face value, but still fairly reasonable compared to where the market was a week or so before.
And we're talking about a stadium that seats how many?
About 100,000 people.
Hmm. So I'm picturing that 100,000 full stadium. How many will be black and gold in that stadium?
I'm guessing 65,000 to 70,000.
Really?
Yeah.
We're in California, and there are going to be more Iowans than those from Stanford.
Absolutely.
How do you explain that?
Iowa fans really want to go to this game. Stanford's been to the Rose Bowl several times in the last 3 to 5 years, and you have any number of local alumni all up and down the West Coast and over into Arizona that for them this is an easy trip to make, and the Hawkeyes don't come play in their backyard very often, and so they're changing their holiday plans around as well to make sure that they're there to take advantage of Iowa's visit to the West Coast.
I understand some Iowans, diehard Hawkeyes, will be traveling just to be outside the stadium.
That's right.
What's the scene there?
I suspect we will have 10 to 20,000 people that make this trip and don't have anywhere to go because they couldn't find a ticket or afford one at the time that they were making their plans. And so they will be there just to experience what is the Rose Bowl.
Wow. What are the stories you've been hearing about the dedication to black and gold? Are there any ones that, even for you as someone who is connected with the Iowa Alumni Association, make you go, wow, that is something?
Well, there are two that really stand out for me. One is a gentleman who played in the Rose Bowls that Iowa was in the late 50s, who is taking his grandchildren and great-grandchildren to this game because he wants them to see what he saw when he played for Iowa back in the day. And that just touches my heart that you have that cross-generational love affair with Iowa and with the Hawkeyes, and this is their way to celebrate it together, that they have that opportunity is just very special. The other one that really stands out to me, this trip is expensive. There's no question about it. A lot of people are going to spend a lot of money. And one of our travelers in particular has been saving a little bit every month since 1991 to travel with the Hawkeyes the next time they went to the Rose Bowl. So needless to say, she had quite a bit of money saved up and is taking her entire family, and I think they're taking 10 travelers with us, all because she put a little bit away over that 25-year period and had it available to spend when the time was right.
That is amazing. So what is the cost of going to the Rose Bowl? I know it varies, but on the low end and on the high end?
Well, for us, we provided a four-day tour for our travelers. If you were buying the chartered aircraft flight direct into Los Angeles, you'd spend about $3,800 a person.
That includes hotel?
That includes the hotel. It includes the game ticket, transfers all across Los Angeles over those four-day period. as well as a parade ticket if you were interested in doing that.
Okay, but as we said at the start, those are long gone.
Those are long gone.
Mm-hmm. Any idea about the amount of money this one bowl game, the Rose Bowl, generates these days? Any idea?
Oh, goodness, I wouldn't even want to speculate.
I saw an article from several years ago. It was in excess of $50 million.
That does not surprise me. I mean, Los Angeles is a very expensive city. Folks will realize that if they haven't already appreciated it by now as they plan out their weekends. Yeah. And for us here in the local economy, it's been an outpouring of support from the travel side, as well as all the vendors that are producing Rose Bowl merchandise that I'm sure will be holiday gifts galore this season.
I was in a shop in downtown Iowa City yesterday, and there was, I'm not kidding you, a line of 10 people. All of them had Hawk shirts in their hands.
Yep.
Standing behind the cash register.
You bet.
Jeff Keeter, thanks for giving us an idea of the fan enthusiasm surrounding this Rose Bowl appearance by the Iowa Hawkeyes January 1st. Jeff Keeter is President and Chief Executive Officer of the University of Iowa Alumni Association. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.